Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Stag Waddy game. Who's first?
I'll go first if you like.
Okay.
Do you fancy it? Okay. It's the leisure and business pursuits of the rich and famous. Oh. All right. Five examples, one fictitious, but which? This is for you to divine. Okay. Phil Collins amassed over 200 items of memorabilia related to the Battle of the Alamo. That's one.
Yeah.
Jack White's vast array of taxidermy includes stuffed gazelles, antelopes, a giraffe, and an elephant's head. Okay. Tom Bailey of the Thompson Twins owns a racehorse in New Zealand called Doctor Doctor. Terminator X of Public Enemy has a black ostrich stud farm in North Carolina. And Grandmaster Flash has a collection of 5,000 mugs. One of those things isn't true. But the rest astonishingly are true. So there we are. We got any clues?
I do. I know Phil Collins definitely does collect stuff about the
Yeah,
Alamo.
He does.
Yeah, so what's the second one was Jack White.
Jack White's, gazelles, antelopes, giraffes, and huge collection of taxidermy. There's Tom Bailey.
I kind of figured if Tom Bailey had a racehorse called Dr. Doctor, it would be a late racehorse. This would be quite a while ago. But anyway, go on, Karen. The fourth one was...
So Terminator X has a black ostrich stud farm in North Carolina. It's good, isn't it?
And the last one was
Grandmaster Flash with his 5,000 mugs.
Oh, dear. I'm going to pick Grandmaster Flash.
All right. No, that's true. That is true. The ringer is Tom Bailey. Tom Bailey, who actually does live, I think he does live in New Zealand.
He does live in New Zealand.
And yes. I think he's a very successful DJ. I think he's done. And Tom Bailey and Alana Curry, my God, they would have made a lot of money. I mean, the Thompson Twins were huge and huge in America too. So I think he's probably quite well set up and just noodles about doing the odd bit of DJing. But no, he doesn't have a racehorse called Dr. Doctor.
So he never did have a racehorse.
And never did. Go on. So what do you got?
That's very good. Okay. The genre is skate punk. Okay.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Skate punk.
That's good.
Think kind of baggy shorts and grazed knees and punk thrash. Okay.
Okay.
So these are five skate punk groups, but one of them was supplied by me. Okay. These are the five. Dead Fucking Last. Good Riddance.
Yep.
Asphalt Gash. No Use for a Name. And Rich Kids on LSD.
Those are great.
Those five again. Dead Fucking Last. Good Riddance. Asphalt Gash, 3 miles from them after the news. No Use for a Name and Rich Kids on LSD.
Those are really good. No Use for a Name, I think, is got to be real. It has to be. Because that's very clever and very arch. As I think is Rich Kids on LSD, because that's precisely what people think skate punks are in America. Dead Fucking Last is brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. It's between that Ashfield Gash. Yeah, that sounds, it could be made. Oh, these are so hard, aren't they? I mean, I think it's probably Good Riddance, because Good Riddance is so kind of weedy and feeble and English, and it doesn't sound remotely like it fits into the whole American skate punk genre. So I'm going for Good Riddance, but I'm bound to be wrong.
You are wrong. You are wrong.
I know. So where did Good Riddance come from? Did they come from Croydon or sort of, you know, from Virginia Water, more likely, actually?
Dead Fucking Home. Last. Okay, these are real. Dead Fucking Last, Good Riddance, No Use for a Name, and Rich Kids on LSD. The one that's not real, made up by me 10 minutes ago, is Ashfield Gash.
Oh, that's very good. That's really okay. Good. You it's win.
Not it's not bad, is it?
No, that's really, really good. That's fantastic.
People, I understand the concept of the Stackwaddy game has been taken up elsewhere. People have been getting in touch with me saying, where can I get a long list of names I'd like to play this with my nearest and dearest at Christmas.
Oh, right. It's a Yuletide entertainment, is it?
Yeah.
Along with Balderdash and Boggle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's have a go. Let's play the Stackwaddy game, Dad. And
we should be putting out a book. You should, Dave, along with your quiz book. You should be putting out the Stackwaddy special.
Yeah.
That's great.
It doesn't really work because, you see, as I said to somebody who was in touch with me this week, hoping I had a long list of categories and band names and so forth, you kind of have to tailor it to the people you're playing with. And in our case, I'm playing with you.
Absolutely.
So I kind of know the things you'd know and the things you might be able to sneak through. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You know the level of the people you're playing with, and it wouldn't be any point giving the average family group five skate punk groups. Wouldn't work at all.
Yes, yeah, try to get Gran involved.
Yes.
It's a game for all the family. Dead Fucking Last.
It's not a game for all the family.
That's very funny. Somebody told me that some podcast is now using it. I can't remember which one it was now. Has now appropriated this idea too. We shall find out who it is and reveal them. Actually, it's very flattering that they do. Good.
It's very flattering. But obviously, they'll be hearing from our legal representative.
Yeah, my learned friends.
And so in the light of this weekend's political news, it struck me there are two dramas about behind the scenes in politics that are available to stream on demand, you know, and very often I go back to them. And here's my question to you. Which is the truest to the actual nature of politics? Is it the West Wing or is it the thick of it? I end up watching both of them, you know, and when you catch all this stuff at Downing Street this weekend involving, I can't believe it involves bald blokes called Lee, actually, somehow. It all sounds like it ought to be a fight between painters and decorators. You know, there's Lee and Allegra and Dom and all these and Boris and all these people. And I think what's truest to the nature of politics? Is it the thick of it or is it the West Wing?
I don't know that much about the West Wing. I know a lot about the thick of it. I've seen all those episodes in the movie. I've got it hundreds of times. I mean, that the thick of it is very clever and it identifies the idea that it's all about your own personal career, isn't it? It's about trying to find something to represent will get you in the news and further your reputation and profile, but without any remote interest in the community that you're meant to be representing. And you can't help but feeling there's a lot of truth in that. The days of vocational politics is that long over? When we were lads, Dave, you felt that people signed up to be politicians because they had a genuine philanthropic, altruistic reason to be involved. Am I right? People tend to kind of slide in now, make their names, and slide out and do something else.
I mean, if we're honest about it, I think that the majority of people who enter Parliament have, you know, perfectly honourable intentions. I don't think there's anything about that. But you get involved in the same game as everybody else, which is all about, you know, who can get in the news tomorrow, and
yeah, precisely.
Whose spin is slightly better than anybody else. I think that probably that one of the differences between the people who represented us when we were sort of teenagers, or you know, in our 20s or whatever, is largely they'd been through a war.
Yeah,
they'd been in the services. They had some experience of command, of leading people, you know, and that applied to Labour and it applied to Conservative and Liberals, you know. Whereas I look at some people nowadays and I think, you're very, very smart, but you know nothing about life at all. You know what I mean? You know about the thick of it world, you know, you're really good at the thick of it world, but
about spin. Absolutely.
So we shall continue to watch with interest. And the thick of it is still absolutely fantastic.
It's absolutely brilliant. You can watch that again and again.
You can. You really can.
And the other thing that amazed me about it is the degree to which they must be improvising. And if they are improvising, how clever that is. You know, Rebecca Front, Chris Addison, you know, they're astonishing, just these just riffs that they go off in. And I was absolutely exemplary.
I was watching last Sunday after we recorded the podcast. I thought, oh, God, I wonder what's happening to the remembrance service, because obviously there won't be a load of people there, you know, telly. And then, you know, so the ceremony was there, but obviously without a crowd. And I couldn't help thinking every time I see kind of new politicians suddenly, you know, they enter the little, you know, the wreath-laying line. I can't help thinking of that wonderful scene in The Thick of It where Rebecca Front is talked through how to lay a wreath, isn't she? By a special advisor walking up and down this conference room holding a ball card, think of something.
Yeah.
Telephone directory or whatever. And it's absolutely beautifully done. I'd say it's terribly good.
It's so genius.
What else were we were talking about? Bob Diddley.
Oh, Bo Diddley. I was listening to a podcast the other day. We reboot our old podcasts and re-promote them. And I've been going through some the other day, and I found one from 2008 where we talked about Bo Diddley. And what an amazing story he is, isn't he? Incredible. And our conjecture then was, did Bo Diddley invent rock and roll? There's also a whole thing about whether he invented gangster rap, but did he invent rock and roll? And I'm keen to hear your opinion about this, because, you know, he was there in the 1940s playing in street bands, wasn't he? You know, the band called the Hipsters, was it? They became the Langley Avenue Jive Cats, and he had Jerome Green playing maracas, and he had a wash tub bass and another guitar. And they got some gigs in the early 1950s in Maxwell Street, I think, in Chicago, playing their old Louis Jordan songs. So there's obviously a bridge between rhythm and blues and blues, old Muddy Waters songs, and rock and roll. But a lot of it's to do with when he got a drummer, wasn't it? Because they got a drummer and a bassist in 1951. So, I mean, would that be earlier than Rocket 88? When did Rocket 88 come out?
Oh, good question. Don't late know. 40, no, it probably might be early 50s, I would have thought.
Maybe early 50s, because that's generally considered to be the first rock and roll.
The thing that struck me, because I was listening to a bunch of this stuff this morning, I got my CD copy of Bo Diddley as a Gunslinger.
Here. Oh, yeah.
One of my many favourite Bo Diddley covers. And if you go and listen to these records, A, they sound fantastic. And B, they don't really sound like rock and roll. They sound like, well, he called it jungle music, didn't he?
Yeah.
At the time, because he said he wanted
African beat.
Wanted to do something different from what anybody else was doing.
Yeah.
And the thing that probably he was the godfather of more than rock and roll was hip-hop. You know, in terms of, it's all about sound. It's all about texture of sound. Because if you listen to those Bo Diddley records, they sound better than the Chuck Berry records that were made in the 1950s in the same studios. There's something about the sound of Bo Diddley records that really warm and vibrant. And also it was this invention of the character of Bo Diddley, wasn't it? Because obviously he wasn't Bo Diddley, he was Ellis McDaniel.
Yeah.
And then doing
much that hinged around a song called Hey Bo Diddley, was it? I mean, you know, so it's self-mythologizing.
Well, absolutely. And that's something that carried on, didn't it, with Public Enemy and 50 Cent and all these kind of people.
Completely. It's NWA.
turning yourself into a larger than life figure. In Bodley Diddley's case, with a kind of rectangular guitar, or you know, he used to make his own instruments, didn't he?
Yeah.
And so it all built up into this cartoon character.
Yeah.
And I was just looking at his discography this morning. And I don't think there's many people who did as many songs or albums which were about himself. So he started off with Bo Diddley. That being successful, he did Hey Bo Diddley. That's still going well. He decided to do Diddley Daddy. Then he took a slight left turn to take note of Jerome Green, his maracas player and kind of mucker. And his next one was Bring It to Jerome. And then he did this thing that I've got here, this CD, this well, obviously an LP in its day, Bo Diddley as a Gunslinger. When the tide of fashion in music changed slightly in the early 60s, he was the first one to do Bo Diddley's a Twister. Because, obviously.
Just got to keep on top of the Vogues.
He did Bo Diddley and Company, Bo Diddley is a Lover, and then, of course, Surfing with Bo Diddley. There is no documentary evidence of Bo Diddley ever putting so much as a toe in the water, let alone hanging 10,
That is
there.
Fantastic.
But he wasn't above doing that. Surfing with Bo Diddley. Even quite late in his career, his recording life, he was doing Big Bad Bo and Bo Diddley is Crazy, So it's all just building up this kind of Viz
entire
character.
Factory, and it's all self mythology, isn't it? It's pretty. What a grand tradition!
Fantastic.
There was a lot of it.
And
Manfred Mann.
Well, yes. Well, a lot of people pinched the British R&B bands of the early 60s. They pinched that idea from Bo Diddley. The idea that you wrote a song about yourself.
Because the Animals had a song called The Story of Bo Diddley, didn't they?
The Story of Bo Diddley.
Which mentions, I think, the Mop Tops. Is that right?
And then but in which the Animals appear.
Yeah, they're playing in a night. Or they go to a nightclub where Bo Diddley in Newcastle. That's right.
And then they just, they fact, describe some kind of exchange with Bo Diddley. And it was obviously just their way of saying, we're not just a bunch of oiks from Newcastle.
Yeah.
We also come trailing clouds of glory. So, we do the story of Bo Diddley and we put ourselves in it. And of course, the first Them album has the story of Them, in which Van Morrison kind of intones the tale of how Them got together in the Maritime Hotel in Belfast or wherever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And loads of people did it. You may remember.
Hey, with the Monkees. 10th Avenue Freeze Out.
Come to that in a second. Do you know The One in the Middle by Manfred Mann?
Oh, yeah.
There's The One in the Middle.
Mike Hogg played the drums. Tom McGinnis played the Diamond Bass. Is that the one?
Manfred Mann plays the organ.
Yep.
Tom McGinnis holds it down on bass. But the one in the middle sings Hey Diddle Diddle because he's
just a pretty face. Fantastic.
It was a bit of a hit, that was.
A huge hit.
And that was actually
5-4-3-2-1. It was the Manfreds. It's the same thing, wasn't it?
I suppose so.
Yes.
With a Manfreds. God damn, thought of that. That's true.
But then there's the Monkees, and then there's 10th Avenue Freezer, which I think mentions the big man joining the band. There's a bit of it's about the story of the group getting together, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a Leonard Cohen song called Field Commander Cohen, not about him, but it's the idea that he casts himself into the role of a kind of spy espionage piece, doesn't he? And there's My Name is Prince and I Am Funky. That's a bit of a calling card. Do you remember Devo, all that stuff? Are we men? We are Devo. I can remember 5,000 word articles in the NME about what devolution meant, the idea of mankind regressing, etc. NWA, lots of that from NWA, MC Ren and Eazy-E, and one of my favorite, and Slim Shady. That's a kind of the Ant Rap, Dave, Marco Merrick, Terry Lee, Gary Tibbs, and yours truly.
Is that how he goes?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Do that again.
It's Marco Merrick, Terry Lee, Gary Tibbs, and yours truly. In the Naughty North and the Sexy South, we're all singing and I am the mouth or something. It's some absolutely weird thing, isn't it? My favourite of any group writing a song about themselves was one by the Monochrome Set. Do you remember them? You probably don't remember.
Yeah, I do know the Monochrome Set. Yeah,
Leicester Square playing guitar. And they had a song called The Monochrome, and the chorus went, The Monochrome Set, The Monochrome Set, The Monochrome Set, The Monochrome Set. And that was the chorus. And the backing vocal was on the word the. So all the rest of the group, I remember seeing them playing it live. It was wonderful. They'd all step forward to the mic and just go, The Monochrome Set, The Monochrome Set. Isn't that brilliant and original and extraordinary?
But if you had to give a prize to the one that still is most powerful as an idea, it's Hey Hey with the Monkeys.
Hey Hey with the Monkeys, completely.
Because if
we're just monkeying around.
You just have to say, Hey Hey, we're the... And you're off, aren't you?
Yeah.
And we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We're just trying to be friendly. Come and hear us sing and play. We're the young generation, and we've got something to say.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
I had a classic example the other day of how having too many records drives you mad, Mark. And I don't know if you'd sympathise with this. I've got too many records, okay? It's a fact, isn't it?
No such thing as too many records.
All right, but I've got a lot of records. And I've got a load of CDs over there, all in drawers and, you know, stuff all over the house. And it's kind of organised, but it's not exact. Anyway, because having a load of records is not enough, is it? I also subscribe to streaming services, so I can listen to even more stuff, you know. And in the course of the streaming services, do things like if you play something and you get to the end of it, it will just, you know, nominate something that's a bit like it, that it's found via its algorithms that people who like this like that.
And down an endless rabbit hole.
I just happened to be listening to something and I hadn't intended to, and I found myself listening to, I thought, that's Ali Farkaturi, isn't it? Surely. Ali Farkaturi, the kind of Malian blues man. And I was listening to this, oh God, this is good. Oh, this is good. I've got this record. Now, it wasn't enough for me to be... I had access to it on the stream. But no, I've got this record. I've got it somewhere. It's on CD.
I've got to go and find it. So,
and honestly, Mark, I was just going up and downstairs for 2 hours. I just couldn't settle to anything at all.
But and isn't it fair to say that with a record collection your size, that if it's not in alphabetical order, where are you going to find your alphabetical... You might as well go start looking in the garden. I mean, it's made a difference, isn't it?
The Ali Farkaturi, you got it's a triple threat there, isn't it? Is it Ali? Is it Parker? Is it Turi?
Is it Turi?
and then you think, well, no, some of that stuff, I tend to put it in a drawer with kind of world music or instrumental music or stuff that doesn't readily fall into any category and doesn't easily obey the alphabet and all that sort of stuff. And so I went to those places, couldn't find it, could not find it, got everything out, couldn't find it. I couldn't settle. It's just ridiculous. Couldn't do any work, couldn't read anything. Life
falling apart.
And then eventually I found it, you know, filed upside down. There it is. Ali Farkaturi, the King of the Desert Blues Singers, is a record called Savan. And I've been playing it ever since.
You must have been so relieved. You must have hugged it. You must have been in tears. You must have been having a little party for one up in the attic, dancing to this magnificent record.
I'm reminded of the old parable from the Bible about, you know, the shepherd spends more time looking for the one that is lost than he spends dealing with the hundreds that he's got, you know. So that's what I couldn't help thinking of. And God, I was relieved. Because I thought, if I keep searching all day and I don't have it, I'm going to have to order it. It's ridiculous. You know, I can listen to it, streaming service, I can listen to it any time I want, you know.
But why do you need to actually have it?
Because I just do. Because, okay, this is it.
See, that's an interesting thing, because if you want to listen to it, it doesn't make any difference whether it's in your household or not.
Okay, well, this is my answer. And this is part of the reason why I'm going to come, you know, like I was rattling on about this the other week when we were talking about, you know, my theory, the CD will kind of come back. It'll never come back quite like vinyl, but it'll come back, you know. Because once you decide you love something.
Yeah, you want to have it.
You want it.
That's true.
You want to have it. To kind of prove that you love it.
Yeah.
Anything else. And so I thought, if I don't have that, I'm going to have to do something about it. And I'm also going to feel bad about myself that did I have it and did I let it go? Which would be a terrible, you know, stain on my character, wouldn't it?
If they, could have given it to somebody. You could have given it to somebody and turned them onto an entire lifetime of world music enthusiasts.
Well, maybe. I don't do that kind of thing.
I don't
give records to people, actually. But anyway, I just thought you might relate to that. You know?
I'm just trying to imagine what sort of state you'd be like if you hadn't found it.
Sleepless
misery.
We wouldn't be
haunted.
We wouldn't be doing this podcast now. I would have been up all night, you know, taking everything out of the house, put it out in the garden, and sorted through it one thing at a time until I found it. So anyway, so this week. Go on, we've been.
Well, I wanted to mention Lloyd Cole.
Yes,
we talked to Lloyd Cole the other day.
We talked to a load of people this week, haven't we? We talked to John Kosh. If you haven't caught that, do catch that. It's the man who designed Abbey Road and loads of other things. Anyway, go on. We also talked to Lloyd Cole.
It was really interesting. Lloyd Cole, here he is in lockdown, he lives in Massachusetts. In lockdown, like the rest of us, and suddenly got some interest from people in his lyrics, in the idea of his handwritten lyrics. And he told us that he gets up in the morning and he spends a considerable amount of time now rewriting, presumably in a fine italic nib, you know, the lyrics to Perfect Skin or whatever it is, and then sells them to people who've got in touch with him. Why not? I thought that was a really interesting idea. And it was very reasonable. I can't remember what it was. It was $75 or something like that for a handwritten manuscript. Also, it would be customised to you. It would have a little message to you at the top, presumably.
Presumably.
I don't think he does that thing where he pretends it's the original version, scratches some words out, and puts other ones in. Or, you know, I don't think as arch as that. But, I mean, the idea that you could... It just made me think there's a huge industry there. Because if you like somebody, you'd love to have handwritten lyrics.
I've never thought of that until he talked about it.
Yeah.
Because we've all heard stories about, you know, Don McLean famously happily...
He found, just suddenly stumbled across, like you looking for your Alifar Katuri record, suddenly found, amazingly, you know, in some cupboard somewhere, the lyric to American Pie.
It was sold for enormous...
It sold for about $1.1 million. And just how extraordinary, 2 weeks later, he found Vincent. What are the chances? Isn't that astonishing?
Whereas Lloyd isn't doing anything like that. What Lloyd's doing is it's a development of selling of your autograph, isn't it, really?
It is.
It's your autograph.
That's all it is. But if it's a song you particularly like, fair enough.
And actually, you know, I've just thought there ought to be a roaring trade in old motel stationery. That's what you want, you know. If you can find a cache of old Holiday Inn notepads
upon which you then rewrite. 70s,
yeah. Upon which you put
your Mr. Tambourine Man. That's right. That's right.
It's just come to me. You know,
and then some, you know, put a coffee stain on it, a cigarette burn.
It's got like a rolling ball crossed out.
Stone, that's it.
Whatever.
That's it.
That's what you need to add further authenticity if you're trying to pass off these things as being what you wrote at the time. No, I was intrigued by this. Because I was just, when we were talking about it, you know how Muhammad Ali made his living for the last kind of 20 years of his life was selling his autograph because it was the only thing that could generate any money, you know, because there's fighters are fighter, you know.
You could argue that the more you sell your autograph, the less its value retains. I don't know. Does it?
Well, he apparently used to, you know, obviously he battled illness of for a long, long time. But he used to go to a kind of public place, and he would sign autographs. You know, I think pretty much daily. And I'm just looking. There are so many Muhammad Ali autographs out there that there is a very good website called aliautos.com, which calls itself the greatest Muhammad Ali autograph resource. And it has large sections on forgeries, and it will give you a quick opinion on whether the autograph you've got really is an Ali autograph. So they can't be worth an awful lot of money, surely not.
I can't, if there's that many of them. I don't think so. No,
no, no. No.
But I love the idea of musicians kind of diversifying. I still love the idea of Dylan and his welding. I mean, he doesn't do that as a commercial enterprise, but he does have his studio, doesn't he, in Los Angeles, where he welds.
Now,
and
wouldn't
he produces artifacts that you
wouldn't
know, that
you buy? Wouldn't you buy? If you could, you know, if you're the kind of person who is going to spend money on a wrought iron gate, garden gate, or whatever, how, forgive me, cool would it be to be able to say, "Do you like it, Bob Dylan made it"?
Bob Dylan made it.
That's really exciting, isn't it?
Incredibly exciting.
I'd rather have that than one of his paintings.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. Absolutely.
Yes, it's a useful thing, you know.
But presumably, once you've announced that that's a gate made by Bob Dylan, then the security of that gate is then very threatened.
I suppose.
It might get nicked, I would imagine. Does Dylan make his own things? I remember when he had an exhibition at the Halcyon Gallery, I think, in London in 2013. And the director said, Dylan designs the works and decides which objects will be used. He does some of the welding himself. But he has one or two people to help him out, and he's intimately involved with the whole process. So I think it's probably one of those kind of Damien Hirst, Anselm Kiefer things where you've got a big factory turning stuff out. But it's brilliant. I think it's brilliant. What a fantastic idea with all these old car hubs and
some rock star ought to start making something that we all want, like garden gnomes or something like that.
Yeah, you
know? Something we all just plonk down in the garden and go. Do you know who made that?
Ozzy Osbourne.
Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah. Nick Haywood of Haircut 100.
That one over there is Les Neems.
Les Neems. Lovely idea.
That's good.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So here we are back again, this time joined by Alex Gold, who's just told us that Des O'Connor's death's been announced at the age of 88. And Alex said, what did you say, Alex?
Des O'Connor toured with Buddy Holly.
And he did. Obviously, he was in those days, you know, those kind of shows, they always had a compere. They always had to have a comic, you know. And but what amazed me, because I just looked it up, is just how many shows they did. Shall I go through these shows?
This was a UK tour, right? Obviously,
UK tour of
1958.
So he was probably, I'm trying to think, he was probably the first of those kind of rock and rollers to come over. Anyway, the tour starts the Elephant and Castle Trocadero. Then the Kilburn Gaumont State, Southampton Gaumont, Sheffield City Hall, Stockton Globe, Newcastle City Hall, Wolverhampton Gaumont, Nottingham Odeon, Bradford Gaumont, Birmingham Town Hall, Worcester Paramount, Croydon, Davis, East Ham Granada, Woolwich Granada, Ipswich Gaumont, Leicester de Montfort Hall, Doncaster Gaumont, Wigan Ritz, Hull Regal, Liverpool Philharmonic Hall, Walthamstow Granada, Salisbury Gaumont, Bristol Colston Hall, and Cardiff Capital and Hammersmith. Isn't that amazing?
Wow. That's a lot of London.
That was like a classic bit of old radio that day, you know, from 30 years ago, where people actually used to read out tour dates on the radio. Made riveting radio, but then you didn't have the information any other way.
But
so
that was a lot of shows, wasn't
it? Oh, yeah, incredible.
Is the volume of London shows in that run slightly unusual? What, Hammersmith, no, Kilburn?
It's probably not that unusual, really, because you wouldn't be. They were, people would play more than one London show, and there weren't big venues. You know, there wasn't a Wembley alternative or anything like that. You know, these places were all however many there were, 2,500, if that. Probably not even that, actually. But I hadn't realised just how many shows that was. So, Des O'Connor. You know,
that would be a good bill. Des O'Connor, good value.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Terrific.
I'm sure. And
also up there with Bob Monkhouse, all those people who were kind of ignored for a long time and thought of us being kitsch and cheesy. Suddenly he's kind of given a certain amount of light entertainment respect.
And also, the thing that kind of made Des O'Connor famous all over again was he was the butt of all Mortimer Wise's jokes.
That's right, it was.
They just had to put Des O'Connor, the name Des O'Connor, into any line, and it was immediately funny. And also he had some hit records, didn't he? Do you remember 1-2-3 O'Leary?
I don't.
That's a big hit. He had more than one. Well, yeah, that's why they used to take the mickey out of him, because he sold a lot of records. And they kind of sing along with Des thing, like Max Bygraves did. Well, so 88, decent innings.
Decent innings, very good innings. Good man. Absolutely. That's fantastic.
So also, Alex, was you were inspired by a mention of Don McLean's American Pie to tell us that is one of your staples in your if you had to play for your life in a hostile pub.
Yeah.
That's one of the songs you do. Go and tell us about that.
Well, it serves two purposes, actually. One is it's about 10 minutes long, and if you play it a little bit slowly, you've basically got 15 minutes of your set covered. add in Champagne Supernova and
you're nearly there.
That's you collect the money and go home.
Absolutely. But also, it's one of these magical songs that just appears to make people participate, no matter where you are, who you're playing in front of, what time of day it is, what state of inebriation or non people are in. It's just got that sort of magical formula that makes people sing without realising they're doing it. And there are a few of those songs that are really useful to have in the back pocket.
What are they?
Don't Look Back in Anger's definitely one of them. Help's another one. Take Me Home, Country Roads. That's right. And, you know, it's quite a sort of disparity of styles there. But for some reason, contained, especially in the choruses, of course, of these songs that just grab people. And once you have them, you've got them for the whole rest of your tenure and the rest of the night.
So have you done these kind of sets where the landlord says, all right, son, there's a stool in the corner, go and sit on that and disturb the peace of these drinkers by playing some songs?
Absolutely. And that's kind of sort of how I figured out to get the attention of a room, I suppose, because if you don't, it's a really horrible experience. You've kind of got no choice but to make people shut up and listen somehow.
How do you do that? You play louder.
Well, there is an element of that as well. There is an element of how you conduct yourself,
which can be very annoying if you're on the receiving end of it. If you're trying to have a meal. So maybe you're out in a restaurant and suddenly you hear somebody tuning up. You think, oh, my Lord. American Pie is interesting because nobody's got a problem with Don McLean. If you played a Bob Dylan song, there'd be certain people who just think, I kind of either subscribe to Bob Dylan or I don't. But he doesn't divide anybody, Don McLean. It's just a great song.
But what you discover as well is that, people do respond to the way in which you conduct yourself. And what I sort of observe watching various singer-songwriters do their thing sort of slightly coyly in the various pubs across the land in the old world was that, there's no, with a lot of them, there's no projection there. And you have to kind of puff your chest.
Let's be more simple about this, Alex. Let me cut to the chase.
Yeah.
Are you saying they don't speak to the audience?
Absolutely not. It's all about...
That's the problem, isn't it?
They're not there to entertain. And, that's what you realise, that you're not there for you. You're there to add something to someone's evening. And, and of course, it's playing songs they know they like, but also making them feel like they're being entertained.
But it's also making that... And where speaking is really important, I think, is it makes them like you.
Well, yeah, absolutely. it is kind of the conversation with the room. You're the compare as well as concerned. And you have to stand up. I always play standing up. I never play sitting down because I find it really difficult when I'm on the other side to really be bothered about someone who's just sitting hunched on a stool, you know, playing.
That's so true. They don't look like they're involved or making an effort or projecting or anything. That's absolutely true.
There's no authority there. And Don McLean, American Pie, it's a magical little piece. The downside is you have to memorize 25 verses. But, you know.
Do you know who, in my experience, if I had to throw on anybody to play for your life in front of the most hostile pub or, you know, or the least impressed gathering of people, and I've seen them do this, is Neil and Tim Finn. Variously have Crowded House, Split Ends, whatever. And the reason is, I've asked them about this, they're absolutely at ease. You know, stand up anywhere and play a couple of songs, look the audience in the eye, get them singing along, all that kind of stuff. And they say, we always had to do this at family parties when we were like 8 years old. They just learnt that's how you do it. That's how you entertain. And it never leaves people.
But that's true of people like Ray Davies, isn't it? McCartney, all those guys. They kind of grew up with sitting around the piano with lots of, you know, pints of mild bouncing up and down on the top of it, I mean, singing along.
McCartney, for example, all that early footage of the Beatles, he's eyeing everyone. You know, he knew exactly what he was doing.
But it's also playing family audiences is a really interesting discipline. Because you're dealing with people who are from wildly different age ranges and interests, whatever. And your job is to bring them together, not to play them your interesting new song.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the kind of indie way. I'll tell you the other thing about live music in unlikely contexts. I was told this by a friend of mine who's a very senior RAF officer who used to organise a lot of these kind of things in Whitehall. Receptions, drinks receptions, where it was decided to do it. It'd be a good idea to warm the room a little bit with a little bit of live music. He said, I have discovered through bitter experience that there is only one instrument in the world that you can't make too loud, and that's the harp.
Interesting. He said,
so he always used to hire a harpist to play in the background of a drinks reception because you simply can't.
Never dominate.
They can't dominate. Every other instrument, Johnny musicians' natural instinct is just play slightly louder.
I would suggest that perhaps the ukulele could be
brass. Okay.
You could still crank it up, though, can't you? You can still turn up the volume, I would have thought.
Yeah. But I suppose this notion of entertaining, you know, I guess it's translating into records now more than it ever has done. You know, I'm seeing various grassroots artists releasing their ballads, and I just think, why? This is 2020. Nobody wants a ballad. The very last thing I want at the moment, apart from having my actual eyes gouged out with a spoon, is to listen to a ballad. I want to listen to stuff that makes me happy. You know what I mean? I mean, do you think that we're going to see less balladry, you know, in a big in the next year or so?
Yeah, when we reemerge blinking into the daylight, it'll be people sitting on stools saying, here's a song I wrote during lockdown. And the audience will just think, oh, bugger it.
Won't be any of that. There simply won't. Nobody's going to want to be reminded of it, are they?
You hear about someone singing about their pain? Not in 20... Do you care, do you? It's just completely bonkers that people are still convinced that other people want to hear about them getting dumped in a year that an actual global pandemic's happened and the Pentagon's confirmed.
I give you that. But you see, going back to your point about speaking, yes. I think people can be made interested in all kinds of things if you tell them. If you would say, this is a song I wrote about a girl who I went out with when I was 19, and she was called, make up a name or whatever. And this is what happened. And this is, she left me at a bus stop or whatever. They're hanging on your every word.
That's true. Absolutely.
They're really interested. Yeah. And they listen to the song with completely fresh ears. Whereas if you just play it, they won't work that out.
Yeah.
They think, here's the fundamental problem with musicians. They think the music is enough.
I think the misconception is with a lot of musicians is that, you know, this piece of music, the emotional gravity is so powerful As soon as I start playing this, people will just drop whatever they've got in their hands, listen rapt, but it doesn't happen like that, does it at all?
Do you know the great gift of Bruce Springsteen is not the individual songs, it's the knack of welding together the songs into a giant story.
Yeah.
All the way through the show, it's telling a story. Some of it's funny, some of it's tragic, some of it's new, some of it's old. But it's all a narrative, everything. It's not.
And you can go and see Bruce Springsteen. You can go and see Bruce Springsteen for the first time in your life and be involved in that. Yeah. You don't have to have followed him all the way through.
No.
I guess going to a Springsteen gig feels like you're at his party, doesn't it?
He always says he wants it to be, he said this for years, it's supposed to be a party, it's supposed to be a political rally, it's supposed to be a religious meeting, it's supposed to be a dance, it's supposed to be all those things. Got it, all that stuff together. But he really understands that business of if you tell somebody something about a song before you play it,
yeah,
they're listening.
Yeah.
Don't tell them afterwards because they've missed it, you know.
The same about DJs. The best DJs are the ones who say, I'm going to play you this record. Now look out for what happens. 2 minutes in, you'll hear the most extraordinary sound.
Yeah.
And try and work out what that instrument is.
How rarely do you hear that?
I know. Very rarely.
Very rarely.
Look out for this extraordinary thing. It's about to happen. Yeah, you have their attention. No, it's a story.
No, definitely. So, what else in any other business, Alex? What have we got?
Any new patrons?
Anything we're going to talk about?
Yeah, so we have a bunch of new patrons actually this week.
Oh, good.
And these are all annual patrons.
Oh, we love
nice, like, good.
Of course, if you subscribe annually, you get a generous 15% discount.
We shin down your digital drain pipe to celebrate your birthday.
Absolutely. That's my favourite sentence.
Your digital half.
We're down your chimney.
If you have
a birthday between now and Christmas, we'll actually come down. We'll abseil down your digital chimney and
rummage through your old records.
Probably pinch something. Go on, yeah. Alex. Go.
So we have Bishop Brian Jones.
Really? Okay. All right. Fine, Bishop.
A real bishop?
I like to think so. Yes.
I do too.
Well, I look forward to seeing the purple when we get round to his birthday.
The indefatigable Nick Fuller.
Indefatigable. The
marvelous Charles Kennedy. Of course, okay. Sir Peter Hackett.
Absolutely.
The magnificent Claire Nestor.
Right. Hello, Claire.
Fantastic. Robert Fincher.
Yeah. Hurrah. Hello, Robert. Hurrah.
Mr. Finlay Napier.
Oh, very good.
Lord,
what a great name. Finlay Napier.
Who was the last one?
Paul Higham.
Excellent.
Well, it's very, very nice to have them all on board.
We have a few more as well. William Maguire, Sean Nubley, Stephen Price, and Kevin Butterworth.
No less welcome.
Terrific. Well, they're very glad to have them aboard.
And
extremely good news.
And they'll be getting access to all the stuff we do, all the word in your attics, they can attend and be in the room when we do further crowdcast chats with authors.
The book videos that we're going to be doing.
We're going to be doing. We've chosen our ten music books of the year, which we'll have a link to that under this, and there's a page where you can learn all about them. And we're going to be doing little videos about each individual one in the next few weeks. And if you're a Patreon supporter, you'll get early access to that. So basically, the way it works on Patreon is you get everything and you get it first and you get it in vision, if it's available in vision, in return for your much valued support. Anything to add?
I think we're there, aren't we? On that long and rambling discourse, I think we're probably there.
Oh, okay.
Very good. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.